Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. On this episode, we'll be discussing iconic television episodes. A lot of people get confused what iconic means. Also, we're going to review Beast Beast and much more. Let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson. Joining me for this episode is my fellow ho, John Davenport.
Hey, Aaron. How you doing today?
I'm tired. It's been a week.
Yeah,
it's been a week.
Yeah, I can. I mean, every week kind of feels like that at this point. This already feels like Thursday, and it's only Tuesday, and I'm ready for Sunday.
Yeah, I follow you. And also joining us, Amanda Sink.
Hello, hello.
Just kidding. That's Troy Heinrichs. Welcome back, Troy.
What's up, my people?
Amanda will not be here for this episode. She actually has. She is doing some medical stuff. She got called away very quickly. What's the right? I don't know what to say. What's too much for HIPAA?
You don't qualify for HIPAA.
Oh, all right. Well, she's sick.
Yeah, she got called away so quickly. I only had 20 minutes to prepare for this episode, and that's still more time than Amanda ever does.
Wow. She is going to cut you so deep. She prepared.
You'd also probably watch The Right Thing.
The Right Thing. That's on Disney, isn't it? That's an astronaut movie?
No. Well, we'll have a whole conversation about what we're going to watch together. And then when we come back the next time,
yes.
She'll watch something that's adjacent, thinking that it's the same exact thing, even though she asked several engaging questions to which of what she should have watched.
That's because last month, Troy, you haven't heard this story.
I have.
Oh, have you? Okay, I don't know if we talked about it on the actual
podcast. I am a listener of the show as well.
I just didn't know if we talked about it on that or Patreon. I didn't know which one we've talked about it on. But yeah, she was supposed to watch Batman vs. Superman, and she somehow watched Justice League. Whatever. That happens.
Not the awesome Justice League that we have now.
No.
The Justice League.
But, you know, we wish her well. Hopefully she's feeling better very soon. Very soon.
I'll leave you to wishing well. I'm okay.
I'm a dick. So there's something I got to talk about before we get into the news roundup. I was told three times on Monday alone by listeners that apparently I cannot be a Sylvester Stallone fan anymore, not because he won't be in Creed 3, and that's a whole different thing, but because he joined Mar-a-Lago. So because he joined this country club associated with, you know who, I was told that I'm not allowed to be a fan anymore because apparently that's a no-no. I don't really want to get into that because I don't care about his personal politics, but I just want to clarify something. There is literally only one impression I can do, and that I can do very well, and that's Sylvester Stallone. So that adoration is going absolutely nowhere. You can't make me not like his movies. You just can't. Can't be done.
What about King Shark? You can also do King Shark now, too.
Exactly. I can. Hey, you want King Shark. You know, I can do so many roles. I'm just not, I'm not joining that bandwagon. Just keep driving. Keep going. And what's funny about that is Stallone has already came out and denied it and said, that's not true. I never joined that club. Back up. But that's how people are. And it wouldn't matter to me anyway, because I don't care. I love his movies. I love Cobra. I love Rocky. I love Rambo. I love his movies.
Not for some reason, I just want to see Stallone in a golf movie.
In a golf movie?
Yeah, he goes around the course just like Cobra hacking Gilmore? And slashing people with a nine iron.
Hey, yo, you're on hole three. Get out of here.
Happy Rambo?
You're the disease, and I'm the cure. Put goose.
Okay, that was stupid. I don't know why I did that. You know what? Let's go to our movie and TV discussion. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore. Here's everything that's happened in movie and TV over the past week that we care about. Okay, one thing I don't care about, which is Bridgerton has been renewed for seasons 3 and 4 on Netflix. A lot of people love that show. Good for you. You're getting a whole lot more.
Most of those are women, and it's like their own personal, like, private show.
It is, and they don't want you to partake in it. That's none of your business.
Nope.
It's already renewed for more seasons than most Netflix shows get ever.
That's not fair.
So there's that. The collector series that was supposed to get a third movie, which Josh Stewart actually talked about on this very podcast a couple of years ago, is officially dead, as the third film has been abandoned because COVID hit and they're not going back to it, according to the producers. China is requiring their theaters to play at least a couple of propaganda films every single week. That's part of the requirements to play movies in China. Oscar nominees and their guests can get essential worker waivers so they can attend the Oscars live, because sure, let's dilute the word a little bit more. Nash Bridges is returning to TV with Don Johnson and Cheech Marin in tow. Elon Musk stated that we could actually build a real Jurassic Park right now if we wanted to. We just didn't know if we should. Indiana Jones 5 is still happening. Harrison Ford's back. John Williams is back. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge is now on board, which is fantastic. Top Gun Maverick has been pushed back to November. Mission Impossible 7 has been pushed back to 2022. But G.I. Joe's Snake Eyes has moved up to July. So that's fantastic. But I don't want to watch Top Gun in the winter. I'm just going on record. It belongs in summer. Carry it over to 2022 or something. I don't know what, but whatever. Lucy Liu has joined the Shazam sequel as the villain. Will Smith and Antoine Fuqua's Emancipation has moved production out of Georgia due to their new voter laws, costing them $15 million. Universal Pictures is doing another Monsters movie with Chris McKay doing Renfield, which is centered around Dracula's henchmen. And lastly, the Arclight Cinemas and Pacific Theaters won't be reopening. Thanks, COVID. Thanks a lot. You killed the Collector 3, and you killed the Arclight Cinemas. So great job, virus.
Yeah, specifically the Panda Dome.
Exactly. There's a lot of really rich people that are complaining about it. I'm just saying they have the money to save it. But whatever. John, of all that, what stood out to you the most as exciting news?
I have to be honest, Aaron. Not a single damn thing of that was exciting, because something else that got announced this week was that Netflix is going to do a live-action Gundam movie with director Jordan Vogt Roberts, which when I saw that and everything else, as much as even I love the Shazam movie, I'm still really excited about this because I think Jordan is a very awesome director just off of the experience I had with him in Kong, Kong Island. To me, he reads like somebody who has an understanding of how to do genre and how to do something in a fantastical live action way with something as crazy as giant mech robots.
I forgot about that. That was supposed to be in the news roundup, but thanks, John. Thanks for covering it.
That's no problem, man. You know what? Sometimes you get upset at me for not paying attention. This time it worked out for your benefit.
Yeah, but let's be honest. It's pretty rare. What do you think of that news, Troy? I don't know anything about Gundam. Do you know anything? I assume you do because you're into this sort of thing.
There was GoBots, there's Voltron, there's Gundam, there's all these giant mega things. Voltron is the only one I watch. So I'm happy that the people that love Gundam are getting more Gundam, because if they can do it half as good as the Voltron series was on Netflix for the reboot, then I think it's going to be spectacular for Gundam fans all over the world. But for me personally, I don't know if I'm in for another Gundam series, to be honest, because I already watched Voltron for, what was it, 8 seasons,
it's
John?
A movie.
And it was great.
It's a movie.
Yeah. Like Voltron was an amazing series. It's just this is just a movie.
Oh, well then maybe I'll check it out.
See, I was listening to you, John. He was not listening. He was like, you know what? I only care about what Aaron talked about. What John brought to the table was not necessary. It was extra.
Well, I just assumed it was a movie and then a TV series and a spinoff to a book and then a mobile game, because you have to have the whole like rights, you know, figured out long in advance before you actually put it on the first thing.
These are all fair points.
They are. What about you, Troy? Anything in all that really got you excited?
Since I'm Amanda, can I pick two?
Sure, you can do whatever you want. What?
The big one for me, obviously, is I'm super excited for the Shazam movie coming out, and Lucy Liu coming in as the villain is going to be completely fantastic because she's just freaking awesome in everything she does. Mm-hmm. But having been to the Panda Dome in Hollywood myself, because it's like something you have to do if you go to Hollywood, I think the loss of an iconic facility like that is really a gut punch, especially when you think Hollywood equals movies, and now there's literally no movies in Hollywood.
Yeah.
That just seems really depressing in many ways. The more important part of that story, though, is that the Arclight cinemas are the only cinemas that I found in a long time that serve real butter for their movie popcorn. Ooh, and so the loss of
that's why it's so expensive.
Yeah, but it's amazing. And I am going to be so depressed the next time I go out that way to not be able to go to the Arclight and get real butter on my popcorn.
What would you say is the selling point of going there? It's huge. It's a huge dome environment. Is it, how many theaters are in there? Do you remember?
I think it was like a standard, like 8 to 10, like mini multiplex. But the dome theater itself is interesting because it's actually like a curved screen. So for my viewing experience, unfortunately, I saw Suicide Squad, which it's not a bad movie, but I wish I would have seen something more iconic, you know, that would have been more epic for the screen size than the squad. But it was fun. I mean, it's interesting because you sit so far back from the screen in the dome that it's almost like it looks 3D, even though it's not 3D because of the way the perception is from where you're sitting in the audience to where the screen actually is and how the screen curves.
Did you feel like you were under the dome?
God damn it. I'm out of here.
I will not address that with a 10-foot pole.
That's it. I'm leaving. Bye.
All right. You know what got me excited is not Oscar nominees and their guests being able to get essential worker waivers, because that's ridiculous. I get what's funny is I can make the argument for Hollywood actors, crew, and that sort of thing. I can make that argument because you know what everybody's been doing during the pandemic? Watching TV and movies. In fact, I heard Bruce Campbell just give that same argument recently. So I get that argument. Going to an award ceremony to get an award because it's, you know, instead of a Zoom call where it's safe, I don't consider that essential. I'm sorry. I just don't, won't, can't. And nobody can really make me buy into that. But it's Hollywood. It's their town. And I guess they feel like they're very essential. So teach their own. I do think the Phoebe Waller-Bridge in Indiana Jones, which I was already on board for Indiana Jones. I don't care if he's 112. I am really interested to see exactly what's going to happen with that. Cause she's a fantastic talent. She's from Fleabag and she was part of Killing Eve, especially the first season. Great writer, great actress. What's that?
Wasn't she the creator of Killing Eve?
Yeah, essentially, but it's based on books. So I don't know if you call that. She's a creator of the show.
She's the adapter.
Yeah. But she's very talented. She's a brilliant woman and I can't wait to see what she's going to bring to Indiana Jones. Because I can't imagine she'd take it unless she was on board with the script. And James Mangold is a great director. I'm really kind of getting stoked. Obviously, Harrison Ford won't be doing many of his own stunts or anything. But I look forward to this. I think it'll be interesting.
What if the mantle shifts to her?
Be fine. You know, I'm fine with that as long as it's something along those lines as opposed to somebody coming in to play him. You know, that's where I think it gets complicated as a fan.
Would you want her to be the protagonist or an antagonist?
I want her. Ooh. I think I want her to be Indy's daughter.
Oh, with like Miriam. Many years later, you find out that they actually had a kid.
Yeah, something like. Well, I mean, they have Mutt Lang, but nobody wants him back. Nobody. Nobody wants Shy back. So bring her in as the other kid, the daughter, or something. I think that would work great.
Not even Shia wants Shy back.
No. Mm-mm. So that's what I think would be great.
You know, I think it's gonna be interesting what we see happen in Hollywood for the next few years, because just going back to this idea of these theaters closing, what I've been noticing as far as listening to some and reading articles is that there's like a mass exodus from Hollywood, from a lot of big name talents.
What do you mean, Max?
There's a
in terms of what?
There's like a number of talents who are moving to places like Georgia, or moving to places like Texas, because there's certain taxes that are being created, like that are essentially quote unquote wealth taxes, and they're going after all the people in Hollywood and all that have the money essentially. So it's going to be interesting to see if Hollywood even remains being Hollywood anymore.
Well, I mean, you already have like Vancouver does most of the TV, Toronto. Mm-hmm. New York mm-hmm. has got stuff going on there. You got Georgia and North Carolina and Wilmington, obviously not as prominent because they passed their tax laws down there that basically kicked the movie industry out of North Carolina, which was just dumb from
right.
a state perspective because it was literally like the entire economy in Wilmington.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's interesting is to see like where does all the stuff in Georgia go for all the people that are fleeing Georgia? Like, are they going to go up to Canada? Are they going to go back to Hollywood? Like, where are they going to end up shooting those things that used to shoot down in Georgia?
Well, Emancipation's going to Louisiana. I saw that. But at the expense of $15 million. Now, I get they're trying to send a message. That's an expensive message.
Mm-hmm.
But message received, I'm sure. Wooza. And I think it is cool that we're still getting these Universal monster movies. And they're kind of looking at different things. And I got a feeling it's going to be another one of those like Invisible Man where it's a lower budget. And they're kind of bringing out Dracula's henchmen as something else to focus on. It could expand the world like they intended to do originally and just tried to throw too much money at it. I like the idea of doing these smaller projects.
Yeah, smaller seems to be better. I mean, if we all remember, Marvel started out small to a huge degree.
Yeah, Iron Man was a tiny, tiny art movie. Yeah.
It wasn't as big as they make them now.
No, true.
In retrospect, it's a pretty simple movie with a smaller budget than what they throw at them now.
True, but it's not small in the sense that I'm talking. I mean,
well, no, you
Invisible Man was $12 million. So, I mean,
right.
You know, that's like, I think that was Iron Man's catering budget. Downey got to eat.
Downey got to eat.
Just saying. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Remember, you can always find more information at thehollywoodoutsider.com. Join our Facebook group or we're on Twitter at BuyPopcorn. And our show is independently funded. Therefore, all the expenses are from our own pockets, and Patreon helps fans support their favorite podcast. Joy Heinrichs is actually a Patreon supporter as well as friend of the show.
That's not why he's here, though.
No, that's not why he's here. No, he didn't buy his way in. And once you sign up, you can get immediate access to all content in your respective tier. We want to welcome Tammy Ray Sparrow. Welcome, Tammy. She will get to pick an upcoming topic or pick a movie we have to review for an upcoming episode. Thank you so much, Tammy, for joining us. We really do appreciate that. And if you want to support the show, you go to patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. That's patreon.com/thehollywoodoutsider. Now let's go to our spoiler-free review. This week, we have one film comes out on the 16th of April to video on demand. It's called Beast Beast.
That's right. And Aaron was able to glimpse this one. It basically tells the story of a teenage girl, a new student at a school, and a gun-toting vlogger brought together by fate. Now, this film was actually an adaptation or even a continuation, if you will, of Danny Madden's short film, Krista. So, Aaron, do you think Danny was right in taking his original work and then stretching it into this full-length feature film, or did you feel it was overly bloated?
No, I thought it really, really worked. It was very fascinating, honestly. It's the whole film is kind of following three primary teens as they are going about different facets of their lives and kind of wanting to be wanted, wanting to be noticed, wanting to be needed. You know, it's part of growing up. And especially in this day and age, there's also the need to be seen on social media at all times. And that's a big factor of this movie. So I really felt like it deserved an expanded space. And the story really, really takes a turn about two-thirds of the way in. But it's an earned turn and really completes a full arc by the time the movie's over.
I mean, there's a ton of these like teenage movies in America. I mean, we talked about
coming
like 13 Reasons Why, things of that nature. So like, what is it about this Teens in America today that makes it different? Like, why should I go see this movie in particular?
I think it's honest, genuine. I mean, it's showing teenagers in the real light that they are in modern times. I don't know if that gets really shown very well. I feel like, you know, anything you see in the CW is pretty much soap opera-y. I really felt like this is genuine. I mean, there aren't too many films I've seen recently that would echo that. The Fallout, but I don't think that's out yet. Aside from that, I mean, this is really, really close to what I feel like real teens are experiencing that I've seen from my kids when they were going through this time period. And you know, it's hard. It's hard for them. You know, each one of them is trying to be seen in their own light. One is doing it through basically gun videos. And I don't mean that to say like it's a woke movie or anything like that. I mean, he's doing videos where he's showing firearms because he wants to be popular. He wants to be seen. He knows these are going to get clicks. Another young man is just basically trying to be seen as a friend, seen as a guy that's worthy of a woman. And then Krista is very much a teenage girl who is in the Instagram phase of her life and in drama class and just wants to be seen in that respect. And all three, Krista, Adam, and Nito are just fascinating characters. And I really like films like this where you have diverse points of view that kind of culminate in a Crash version of storytelling where they all connect at the end.
I like that you mentioned Crash because that's kind of one of the things that as I was reading about this movie, where it's almost like three independent films that are then intertwined together for the final act.
Pretty much.
Do you think that intertwining actually works, or do you think it was just a trope that Danny used in this version?
No, I think it works. I 100%. I know that there are some critics who are already taking note with the turn, how the story turns in that third act. I didn't have that problem. I felt like it was building very genuinely to that and where it goes. Though I was caught a little off guard with how it got there, it was fascinating the whole way through. So I was intrigued and it was off kilter a little bit. Kicked me off my toes a little. I didn't see everything coming, which is always nice. I don't get that very often, but it still felt earned, which is usually the problem
with things that catch you off guard is usually like, well, that's ridiculous. That's why I didn't see it coming. This felt like it made sense.
Well, when Beast drops on April 16th, if $10 was the full price of a mission, Aaron, what would you pay to see it?
$7.
That's fair.
All right. Well, now let's go to our From the Outside In topic. Okay, we are talking iconic television shows. And if you didn't know who Troy Heinrichs is yet, he's also the host of the Blacklist Exposed, the Under the Dome podcast. See, joke, throwback, worked great. He's done a ton of TV podcasts. He'd be on Westworld that we do together. I also do the Blacklist Exposed with him. He's known for television. So this is a perfect topic for him to join, even though it was last minute. He fit perfect. Okay, now iconic shows are typically defined as widely recognized and well-established. And, you know, it should be noted that they're far and few between. We took a poll in our Facebook group, which we'll read those top 10 when we get there. But what was interesting to me is how often people saw an episode they loved as iconic, where I wouldn't say that would be defined as iconic. So why do you think that, what do you guys define as iconic? I should ask that like right off the bat. Like, how do you personally define? We know how it's defined, but there seems to be some confusion. So how do you see it?
Well, I think for me, iconic, when you talk in the terms of episodic television, is it's something that, you know, the industry is like one kind of thing. Well, they'll talk about the Lost pilot was so much money and, you know, it paved the way for so much things to come before it and things of that nature. I don't think that's the iconic piece of it. I think the iconic piece is when you talk to TV fans who are either a super high on the particular show, first of all, but even the people that are not super high on that show, where they can come together and they can say, man, did you see this episode? And then just go, wow, that episode was great. Even if you're not a fan of the show, they can agree and they know, and it's been in the zeitgeist, so that when they're talking about it, it's definitely an episode that stands out overall amongst all the rest.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I would say as well. However, I would add the, when you're going to present a show to somebody, say, you know, hey, you really need to watch this show, and you decide, hey, what episode of this show is the one that somebody needs to see? And you say, okay, look, just watch this one episode. I know it's going to be out of order, and I know it's not going to make a lot of sense, but just watch this one episode. And if you think it's good after that, then watch the show. And that's usually the choice that, and that's how I usually see in like a choice as what iconic means for the show. Also, when it comes to imagery for the show that leaks out into the world, you know, things that get into people's, like pop culture, that one image that is synonymous with the show. So that is usually from that one episode.
Yeah. I try to think of, obviously, things that reside in your subconscious from pop culture. You know, you think in terms of, what was it, the WKRP in Cincinnati, the Turkeys Fly episode. You know, I would consider that iconic because every Thanksgiving, people are constantly bringing that up, right? So that would be defined as iconic. That's the one episode you remember of that show, and it's an iconic episode of television you remember because of that moment. You know, there are a lot of those kinds of issues. To me, really, it comes down to, this is the best that series had to offer. This is the best, some among the best that television has ever had to offer. And that's how I arrive at iconic. So when people like name off four or five episodes from the same show, to me, that's not iconic. That is, those are your favorite episodes. You know, if you name the one and then bam, like John said, an instant image comes to mind, that's iconic to me. So why do you guys think so few episodes of television ever really become iconic?
You know what, as far as iconic is something that you're going to put on a pedestal, and it means something, and it has power, and it has strength all by itself. And frankly, not everything has all the pieces of the Venn diagram to develop that iconic episode.
Yeah, if you were to talk about from a four quadrant box summer blockbuster movie template, I think that has to be the same case for an iconic episode. And one of those quadrants is that the show itself has to be almost groundbreaking or iconic. Because you have so much television out there, you know, when you think about like MASH, Lost, Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, there are series that are just monster series in their own right. So then that iconic episode is easier because you have a series that stands out versus if you just throw out like, you know, any other just generic TV show that's out there, like oh, I don't know, Fresh Off the Boat, or what am I watching? Even Goldberg's, right? Goldberg's is great. It's funny. It's awesome. But there's like no like iconic episode, because not everybody thinks of the Goldbergs in like in a zeitgeist kind of feel. You have to have that zeitgeist mentality of the show first before you can pull an iconic episode out of it.
Oh, I like that. That's a good description. I never even would have added zeitgeist. That should be part of every conversation just because it's a fun word to say. Zeitgeist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's get into it. Let's talk about iconic. Now, in terms of iconic, we want to start with the ones that are widely accepted as iconic that also speak to you as a fan. So give us, we're going to go around. You can just do your two on your turn, but we're going to go John, Troy, and myself. Give us your two episodes, John, first.
All right. So my first episode iconic. I want to talk about is from How I Met Your Mother, and that's the Slap Bet episode. This is our introduction to the Robin Sparkles little bit of the show, and that Robin Sparkles is used in GIFs. It's used as a response to things. It's out there and it's everywhere. But on top of that, the whole idea of the slap bet, which is something that people started doing, and it also exemplifies one of the great things about this show, about how well it plays with its own memory, because the slap bet happened in this episode, but it was something that carried through the rest of the series all the way to the very last episode. Again, it's something that just brings you right back to this episode, and it's great.
What is the slap bet? Is that like Seinfeld's The Contest? is that what it is, or what?
Well, slap bet. So Barney and Marshall are just, when it comes to Robin, let's just get a little bit of the background on it. So people find out that Robin has this problem with going to malls, and it's like, why does she have this problem with going to malls? So Marshall says that she was married before, and Barney says it's because she's done porn. So the two of them, because they have this bet, they say, okay, well, if you're right, I get to slap you. And if I'm right, you slap me. You get it. You get the idea.
The gist, yeah.
The episode carries forward, and it turns out that Robin was never married, so Barney takes his chance to use his slap on Marshall and slaps him once. And then Barney discovers from somebody in Korea that there's a secret tape that of Robin Sparkles that has Robin in the tape. So they're starting the tape, and they pause it, and Barney says, is there anything you want to tell me? And Robin goes, what are you guys doing? And that's when they tell her about the bet about slapping. So she plays the tape. And so Barney, thinking that he's right and it's porn, goes ahead and slaps Marshall. Well, after this, it turns out that Barney's also wrong. So now Marshall gets 5 slaps, either a choice of 5 slaps, or he gets to do 10 slaps right there and then. Or 5 slaps whenever he wants. So this is where the whole slap bet playing throughout the rest of the series happens, because those 5 slaps are things that he doles out from season to season, and they find new and interesting ways to make it funny.
Okay, I could see how that can become iconic, especially for diehard fans of the show.
Especially after you got through the 4th one, and you're like, when is the 5th one going to happen?
Yeah, because that one was pretty intense. The 5th one was just amazingly intense. And then my second show that I want to bring up, and this has to do a lot with, when you think of Lucy, you think of Lucy wearing the chef's hat. And that whole thing with Lucy wearing the chef's hat is from I Love Lucy, Job Switching. And that's an episode where Lucy and Ricky decide to switch jobs. And so he's going to stay home all day and do the housework and do the cleaning and do all this. And then she has to go out and get a job. So she gets a job in a candy factory, and her and Ethel are essentially doing the absolute worst jobs possible in a candy factory. Meanwhile, the guys are at home doing the absolute worst job and tearing apart the house and exploding chickens and everything you can think of in the house. And it's, again, this is one of those episodes that, when you see Lucy, you see her wearing the chef's hat from inside the candy factory. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that makes this episode great is the Ricky side of it, because he actually gets completely overshadowed in what he's doing, because he equally is as funny and as goofy as Lucy is. And it's a pretty fun episode for those reasons.
And it's rare, because he's never, I'm not discounting him, he's usually the straight man, more or less.
Yeah.
But it's rare he gets the opportunity to be as funny as Lucy. And that's probably why it's
true. Yeah.
Those are two great picks, man. I love Lucy. I do. I always.
I'm leaving again.
Thanks,
bye.
Thanks. You're welcome. That was one of those shows that I just absolutely adored. She is a gem. And I know she's not, can you be underrated when you're an icon? But I still think she's underrated. Like these days, I don't think she's appreciated because of all the comedy she crafted and led forward.
No, she definitely paved the way for a lot of the comedy we have these days.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and Desi, on the other hand, is also somebody who paved the way for a lot of the acceptance that the Latin cultures are receiving these days. Because what you don't know about, or what you may or may not know about the background of that show, is that Desi, nobody wanted to pick up the show because nobody wanted to see a mixed race couple on television. And that was the argument, was that they were a mixed race couple. So it took some work to get them on television and then to get them sharing a bed and then get them to be all this other stuff. So, yeah,
that's great. TV icons. Troy, what do you get? Now, should we mention Amanda's picks too? Or do you want to cover that? Or you want me to? What do you want to do before you get to yours?
Yeah, you can cover Amanda's.
Okay. Well, one she wanted to mention, I want to know what you guys feel about this. Now, I will say her first one is definitely iconic. I don't know how you could argue it's not. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Once More with Feeling. Now, that is the musical episode. In my opinion, still the only musical episode that's catchy enough to really need one. You know, I still think it's the only episode of television that ever really needed to be a musical. That one really worked. What are you guys' thoughts on Buffy Once More with Feeling?
I would say you're right in the Buffy choice. I would say that Scrubs the musical is just as iconic as Buffy, but it doesn't exist without the Buffy happening first. But that is a freaking great episode for Scrubs.
Is it? Because I didn't even know they had a musical episode.
Well, that's because you don't like Scrubs. So.
But it's not iconic. People don't know Buffy, but they know that they had the musical episode. Just saying. Hey, I'm just saying.
Yeah, see, you just spent your coin on the wrong Scrubs episode. It's the Brendan Fraser episode of Scrubs that is iconic. Well, anyhow.
That's different. That's different. Yeah. That's the feels episode.
All right, back to Buffy. Back to Buffy.
Here we are using Scrubs to overshadow Buffy. So yeah, that episode is actually amazing, and I think you're absolutely right that it needed to be a musical, and it was something that, like, musicals up until that point were something I kind of avoided because I was just rolled my eyes at it, and that made it very fun and engaging, and yeah, it's great.
Good, glad we can all agree that's still a soundtrack I will listen to on occasion, if you can believe it. Don't know why. I don't know if I'm allowed to anymore because, you know, showrunner. But the other episode, Dexter the Getaway. Now, if you don't know which one that is, it's the one where he's a lumberjack. I'm just kidding. It's not that one. It's not that one. It's the season 4 finale where he gets John Lithgow, but he doesn't get home in time for his woman. That's what she has is iconic. What do you think? And, you know, she's dead in the bathtub.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that qualifies. Because when you think of Dexter, you don't think of that episode or even that scene.
I do. That's the ending I think of. That's probably the first thing that comes to mind when I think of the show. Because he's holding his baby son and blood.
Yeah, I got nothing.
All right.
What about you, Troy?
Sorry, Amanda.
I've never watched Dexter, so I plead the fifth.
Well,
I think there are more iconic episodes than that one.
Okay.
In the plethora of television shows to pick from.
Well, Amanda, that's one to two. Sorry. It's not iconic. but then again, I think the Scrubs idea should have been scrubbed. So what do you got? Troy.
I'm sending it to you to make you actually watch the episode now.
Yeah, I can't wait to fall asleep to that. What do you got?
For me, I'm going to start with a number, and that number is 33, and that is the pilot episode of Battlestar Galactica. This episode is one where you tell people, like, you should watch Battlestar Galactica, and then when you're done watching that, there was actually a four-hour movie that happened before this, so if you really want to know what's going on, go watch that four-hour movie and then continue on with the show.
I remember telling people that.
I was like, what the hell is going on? It's like, oh, wait, there were like four episodes before this? Okay. Yep. But no, 33 is, I think what 33 did was it set the stage for a different kind of sci-fi experience that we haven't seen on television up to this point because of the grit and the tiredness and the weight that every 33 minutes, the crew of Battlestar Galactica and the rest of the human race that left Caprica are fleeing from the Cylons constantly over and over and over again. And every 33 minutes, they're preparing for battle and the Cylons show up and they barely escape because the jump drive is recharged. And they just it's just constantly barraging for that entire hour. And then right at the last moment, the humans get a victory. And it sets up this entire arc for the entire first season where in the first season, it feels like humanity has no hope. And then the finale of season one gives them that glimmer of hope for the first time. And so they literally see the entire season play out in this one episode to start the show. And it's just, you get to be with the characters in a very gritty, real moment. So you see who Starbuck is, you see who, you know, Captain Adama is. You just get to see like a lot of these characters in like their worst possible situation to know what kind of characters they're going to be. And it basically sets you up for the rest of the run.
Yeah, that's a great pick. Yep. I would agree with that one.
Yeah. That's a pretty solid pick.
Now I want to go rewatch Battlestar Galactica. I really
don't do it.
I really do.
Just make sure you pay for the commercial free version on Peacock, because when you throw the commercials in, it sucks.
Buddy, I got the box set. What are you talking about? All right.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm going to put an actual disc into a tray. I'm going to put that bitch in and I'm going to watch it.
Like a baby?
Exactly. Exactly like a baby.
Until his nephew comes over and then breaks his disc.
Oh, man. That'll happen. That'll happen for sure. All right. What's your second one?
My second pick should come as no surprise from this TV show about a bunch of people on an island. This one is actually the season 4 episode, The Constant. And this is an episode where people that actually understand Lost and get lost and know that it's a character-driven show and not about the island.
Go piss right off.
This is the story of Desmond Hume and his battle with coming off of the island to a freighter ship. And because of that, he has some temporal anomalies going on with his brain as he's flashing back and forth between the past and the current present. And if he keeps flashing back and forth, he'll basically die if it keeps happening, because he'll basically lose his whole grip on reality. And his one constant to make himself whole again and stop the time jumping from happening is the love of his life, Penny Widmore. And it's just a real testament on the acting capability of the guy who plays Desmond. And then, of course, just the connection of people, the connection of longing, the love that people have. Because in this particular episode, as he's jumping back and forth, him and Penny are actually breaking up in the past. And she wants nothing to do with them. And he's basically ruined her life and doesn't want to see him again. And so you're like, oh my God, if they don't get together, he's going to die. Like, he can't die. He's the guy, right? He's the guy that knows all the stuff about the island. And as it plays out, as it goes along, he finally says, hey, I'm going to call you on Christmas Eve on this particular day and date. Please be by the phone, so that when he's in the present, he actually does make that phone call. And Penny just happens to pick up, and it's like, oh my God, all the feels every single time. Just watch it and you just go, this is why we watch Lost. It's because it's for the characters, it's for the emotion. And when you talk to people, it's like, that's the one they pick out from the entire series.
What's interesting about your description there, Henry Cusick is his name.
Henry Cusick, yes.
Yeah. As you said, that nothing can happen to him because he's the guy that knows everything about the island. It's almost like the island matters. Yeah.
At that point in the show, we all thought the island mattered.
Oh, yes. And then it just stopped mattering because we didn't care anymore because they couldn't figure it out. I understand. Yeah, these White Rock, Black Rock. Yeah, it all makes sense now. Anyway, that is a great episode of television, even though it wasn't all about the characters. We can argue that all day. That's a different show. But in terms of that particular episode, that was brilliantly structured. And I could see why some see that as iconic. But I would argue a different one would be iconic, but I'll let John, I don't know if John wants to speak to this one before I say anything about the other one.
No, I love this episode, and I think this is the episode that I would point somebody to say, if you have any interest in checking out the show, watch this episode first and then make a decision based off of that.
See, I think Through the Looking Glass is probably more iconic for me. Like, when I think of the show, that's the episode I always think of. Not Penny's Boat, not Penny's Boat, not Penny's Boat. That's always the episode I think of. Because for me, probably because for me, it was the most moving episode, because Charlie finally accepts something dire and basically is a hero in that moment and does everything he could to warn people, to tell people of the things they needed to know. I'm trying not to spoil something that's like 10 years old, 15 years old, whatever. And the show for me was never the same after that episode. So, I mean, that was my peak, but I could see The Constant for sure. That's beloved by many, and it's really, really brilliantly structured.
I mean, if you talk about a real iconic episode where it's like you have to watch this episode and you'll be hooked, I think season one, episode four, Walkabout, that episode was the one where you just kind of like literally crapped your pants and went, what is this show and what just happened?
Oh, when you find out he was in a wheelchair the whole time?
Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah, I ruined that for you.
Through the Looking Glasses, that one you have to say is, when it comes to what's out there in pop culture, that image of the hand with Not Penny's boat on it is out there everywhere.
And that might be for me why it stands out. All right, so my two, Breaking Bad, Ozymandias. And the title alone really explains what they wanted to say is Ozymandias as the sonnet or poem written by Percy Shelley, which detailed a traveler who comes across this broken down statue of Ozymandias, the King of Kings. Behold what I have built, only to be centered in a vastly empty nothingness. Essentially foretelling that Walter White's ending was going to be a king with nothing to show for it. So the episode takes this real quiet minute to reflect on the calm of Walter's previous life, you know, before starting meth, before he got into it, you know, everything that he had already in his grasp, and he just let slip away for this fleeting need he had to be powerful and rich and feared. And so then we shoot back to where they're in the desert in the aftermath of a shootout, which I still commend them on the previous episode not ending on this portion of this episode, because, you know, you actually end on the shootout from the previous episode and you're like, well, what happened? Well, this starts right where that shootout is. And it's very pivotal to the rest of the episode. And I'm so glad that they did that, because you get the aftermath of the shootout. Hank's wounded. Walter's desperately trying to save both of their lives from Jack, because he's always done this. He's always been able to talk himself out of whatever situation he's gotten into, but he'd never gotten into it with these guys before, and they were on a different level. And the moment when Hank looks at him and says, "You're the smartest guy I ever met, but you're too stupid to see he made his mind up 10 minutes ago." It's one of the most heartbreaking moments in television I can remember. And I saw all my favorite characters die on Game of Thrones. So this was particularly brutal. Walter loses his family, his money. Jesse becomes a meth slave. Hank loses a lot more. And the episode ends with this family destroyed and Walter White on the run. And it's still one of the most carefully plotted, scripted, and shot episodes of television ever.
Yeah, this one's amazing. This is that episode right here for sure. I love it, and that's a good choice.
Yeah, and I think it's because of the way the previous episode leads into it, as Aaron said. Because I remember the previous episode going like, "What?" Like, and you have to like immediately hit play to see the next episode, and then just to watch like what? Why are they going flashing back and stuff? Like, just tell me what happened, and then they get to it, and it's like, oh, okay.
And I love that they call it Ozymandias, because there's one thing that I always thought was funny was, you know, Watchmen, people said it was such a mystery. I'm like, the guy's name's Ozymandias. I mean, if you know the poem, he's probably the bad guy. I'm just saying. So my other iconic episode, and this is my favorite episode of this entire series, it's also the one that I know back to front to back. I absolutely adore it. And I loved it so much that my coworkers gave me a creeper with a dummy attached to it on Halloween once, because they knew that I would appreciate it. It was one of the best gifts I ever got. It was so thoughtful. Home from the X-Files. This is the episode that was so controversial. It was actually pulled from repeats and only aired once on Fox. The only time it didn't air again until like a year later on FX or something like that for one of their 24-hour episode plays. There were so many complaints, they pulled it from rotation. So Holmes finds Mulder and Scully investigating this deformed infant that was found in a sandlot, only to locate the Peacock family. And they've lived in the same house, off the land, with no power or water for eons. And they procreate through family means. And what I mean by that is they make Jamie and Cersei look like amateurs. So they get into it. So it's nothing less than one of the best episodes of television ever. It's the best episode of horror TV ever. And it had a limbless woman on a creeper who was more terrifying than anything Jason or Freddy ever did. That's my number two.
And I believe that's the only episode that ever carried a TV MA rating and had a viewer discretion warning in the front of it for the entire series.
Yeah.
That's such a good pick.
Do you guys remember that one?
Oh, yeah. This is a solid pick. This was This is one of those few times where TV actually freaked me out.
Was it like bury a kid alive in that episode?
It was very unnerving. It was very unnerving. Yeah, go. I don't want. This is one I'd never want to spoil for people. I really want people to watch it. Go. It's on Hulu. The whole X-Files is on there. Find Home. I believe it's season 4. Go watch that episode. This is definitely one you don't need to know anything about anybody. You can just watch the episode. It is a standalone. And my God, it's good.
Yeah, second episode of season 4.
Yep, there you go. Okay, so now give us one episode of television that you personally find iconic and why. John, same rotation.
All right. So the one that I'm going to bring up is something that I'm sure we have a lot of listeners who are going to agree with me, and that's from Doctor Who, and it's an episode called Blink. It's from 2007. And this is David Tennant, but it's actually very David Tennant light because this is the episode that introduces us to the Weeping Angels. And it stars Carey Mulligan as Sparrow, who is called to a mansion and because she got a note. And it's just an amazing piece of television. This is another one of these examples of something that... when you show an angel to somebody, they know immediately where it's from, what it means, and how important this episode is. This is also my episode to show to people when people say, why should I watch Doctor Who? Watch this one episode. And you can see what kind of brilliance goes into this show to create something like this. And again, just spectacular. Chef kiss for this one.
But what does it mean to you? Like, why did you pick that one? Does it connect with you in a certain way?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like this is again one of those pieces of television that scared me, and not really, not like Home did, because when I saw Home, I was like, I am not going to Alabama ever. But
it was Pennsylvania, just so you know, it was Pennsylvania.
Same difference. Yeah. You know, it's one of those. Yeah, what's one of those Nez ones? Florida is another one that scares me. But hey, I live there, so whatever. This is one of those. It's just. The way it's shot, the way it's filmed, what the way they tell their story, how they use the doctor. It's just engaging at every single realm.
It's good.
That is good. Now, Amanda's personal pick is actually number one on the listener poll, so you guys can wait for that one. So, Troy, what is your personal iconic episode?
Yeah, I think this one's a little bit of a way back machine since I'm older, but I really enjoy when people talk to me about West Wing, and it's called... The Two Cathedrals. It's one of the later episodes of season 2. It basically breaks down this way that Jed Bartlett is president of the United States. He has lied to the people that work for him and the people of America that he has MS. And there's a tragedy that kind of happens at the end of season 1, and that kind of plays into what happens here at this point in season 2, because he has his basically right-hand administrative assistant that's been with him his whole life. So the episode previous to this, something tragic happens to his administrative assistant, and we're basically at the funeral for her in this episode, The Two Cathedrals. And you get a little bit of a flashback about her life and how Jed and her met and his relationship on why he believes so deeply in the Lord Almighty, God our Father, Jesus Christ, and all of the church stuff that he puts into his presidency. And so when this woman is taken from him, and he literally has this, I think it's like a 5-minute monologue of a discussion in an empty cathedral, president versus God, and just the raw emotion that he faces in his faith crisis that he's having in this moment about, you know, why... I've done everything for you. I've praised your name. You know, I relations with Mexico are better. I've created all these jobs. You know, I did everything you wanted me to do. Why did you take her from me? And he basically tells God to F off, because when he was a younger kid, he smokes a cigarette and drops it in the chapel at their boarding home and puts it out, and his dad basically scolds him for disrespecting God's house. So at the end of the monologue, he actually lights up a cigarette, smokes one puff, and then drops it on the ground and puts it out and walks out on God, basically. And oh, so wow. it basically is like as a testament to his entire presidency and just how he turns his back on God. And then how does he deal with that and move on into the election that's coming up to get him reelected?
That's interesting. I totally forgot about that episode. That's a great episode. I remember that one now. Martin Sheen is the bomb, right?
I mean, yeah, definitely. I mean, he still was. I mean, he was in, I saw him in something recently. I don't know if it was a TV show or a movie. I mean, still bringing it to this day.
Still bringing it. And Emilio is on Mighty Ducks on Disney Plus, starting to look like Martin.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Definitely in the weight factor.
All right. So, wow. All right. So definitely my personal pick that is iconic to me. I think you guys will know it once I explain it. You might not know it off the title, but Moonlighting. It's called Atomic Shakespeare. It's like this Princess Bride version of Shakespeare via Moonlighting, as the Taming of the Shrew with sexy satire, pop culture riffs, and a fantastically musical wedding. And it's so bonkers. It's absurdly beautiful. And it's always been one of my favorite episodes of television ever. It's also like a prime example of why Moonlighting, when every cylinder was firing, was one of the best shows on television ever. Like, that show was able to be way more than just another cute couple, flirty, romantic mystery detective show. There were so many other things happening. They did so many breakings of the fourth wall. They did this episode, which was ridiculous, but amazing. And then they just kept doing things like that throughout the run up until things fell apart. Like, I'll never forget, I think it was season two finale. They had been fighting and had so many issues that they couldn't finish the season. So they ended the episode on the back lot, basically saying that they couldn't finish the season. It's like, it was just, they had so many moments of brilliance, but this one episode really captured all of it, because I don't like The Princess Bride. I'm not a fan, but this has a very similar story structure and it worked brilliantly for me. Do you guys know which episode I'm talking about?
No, I missed that one.
I mean, it's a long time ago. Well, that's even older than me.
It's a wonderful, no, it's not. It's a wonderful episode of television. Atomic Shakespeare, Moonlighting, Bruce Willis at the best he's ever been, Cybill Shepherd at the best she's ever been, and that episode is the best that show ever was. So if you can ever find it, it's a great one. Honorable mentions, John, anything?
I got one that I want to talk about, which is Supernatural, Changing Channels episode from season 5, episode 8. If you've seen anything from some images from Supernatural, you've seen them either killing things or you've seen images from this one episode. And if you don't remember what the episode is, or you want to get his quick synopsis, Sam and Dean get sucked into an alternate universe by an angel or a trickster demon or whatever it is that he is, and they get put into episodes of television. So there's like a spoof episode of Grey's Anatomy that they're in, which they call it Dr. Sexy, and they do all the tropes from Grey's Anatomy. They get sucked into a sitcom and do a bunch of sitcom-y tropes. They get sucked into a Japanese game show. And one of the reasons why I think this episode is so iconic is because for the show itself, this is the episode where they said, hey, by the way, some point, we're just going to make the show about these two clowns and not really give a shit about monsters anymore. And they kind of held to that premise, and they allowed these two characters to just have so much fun with these roles.
Son of a bitch. That's literally everything I know about Supernatural. Son of a bitch. I've seen that scene, I don't know how many times.
Yeah, and this is instead of him saying like angrily or anything like that, he just says it with so much fun and caring. He's like, son of a bitch.
All right, Troy, what is your honorable mention? Anything?
I'm probably going to have to go with, I would have to say one that really stands out was season 4, episode 19 of Fringe, which I'll have to tread lightly here because I don't think Aaron has gotten this far yet in his watch. So I don't want to spoil it for him because it's amazing. But
I'll eventually finish it. I promise. I think.
Yes. Yeah. Season 4, episode 19 was a backdoor pilot, if you will, to basically earn the fifth season of Fringe. It actually gives us a glimpse into the future with, of course, our good friend and brother, Desmond Hume, as the actor in this episode. And maybe that's why it's iconic. I don't know. But it basically sets up the stage for what in the hell has been going on in Fringe the entire time. And it kind of gives you the answer. And then season 5 is like, how do we solve the problem? And so I think when people go back and look at Fringe and say like, wow, this was totally out of left field. It never really fit the structure of the show because it was literally dropped in the middle of a season while we were already on a pretty intense pace for the end of the fourth season, that it just stands out, and you just go like, wow, I can't believe they made that piece of television in a show that actually connected to everything else when none of the major cast was actually in the show to begin with. So it was just fascinating on how much effort they put into that to make it happen. And Clark Middleton was in that episode as well.
Oh, poor Clark. I miss Clark. Well, mine is going to be one that I think everybody here is going to know right off the bat, but you might think something happens in it that doesn't. It's Walking Dead: Last Day on Earth. This is the season 6 finale. It's the episode where Negan first appears, where we first get Negan rolling out of his camper and everybody lined up on the ground waiting for justice. He gives that big speech about eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and you can cry, and you see him wield his Lucille down on somebody. We don't see Glenn and Abraham actually die in this episode. So you might think, well, wouldn't that be more iconic? I don't think so. I think actually this is the episode where Walking Dead stopped being great television.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
For whatever reason, they decided to hold it over, and I get it, probably because they, you know, for ratings, bring people back to find out who died and everything else. But I thought this is the only episode where Negan was threatening, in my opinion. I actually enjoyed Jeffrey Dean Morgan's performance in this episode. He was intimidating while also kind of being wily and kind of a little nutty. And the whole episode, the build up to that moment was fantastic. While they're trying to play games, they're showing their dominance, and Rick is being played the whole episode. Rick and his whole crew is being played the whole episode. It's actually a really well-structured, well-built episode, and everything up until that moment was fantastic. But as soon as they came back, they kept getting things wrong. And you'll notice the ratings plummeted after that. They just, every year after that was like a 50% decline. They just never measured up to the greatness that was that episode and many episodes that came before that, you know, the Flowers episode and a lot of other ones. But that is the one that will always be in my mind. Whenever I think of Walking Dead, the first picture I come up with is Negan standing over them, because I think that was the defining moment of the show for me. I was like, God, this is the greatest moment of television. Holy shit. They've always been one step ahead. They figured things out. Da, 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 da. They've all been duped. They've been played. And then it comes back to this weak, gratuitous, excessive, just dumpster fire. Literally. Yeah,
season 7, episode 1 was probably the grossest thing on television I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah, it's completely unnecessary too, wasn't it?
Totally unnecessary. Yep. I mean, not even like the smashing of their heads, which was just way over the top, and the fact they focused on it to the point where like the eyeball was, no. I mean, but then like Rick escapes and he's like hanging from the zombie, and the zombie's like literally being torn apart from that bridge, and you just see the guts extending out and separating. It's like season 7, episode 1 just took it in a completely wrong direction. It was always about the humanity, and now it was just about the gore and the violence.
Yep.
Yeah, that was officially the episode that I just turned the TV off and looked at my wife and said, I'm done. And I have not watched another episode since. I could not do it anymore. And though I actually read the comic, I knew it was coming, but after that episode, and especially how they showed it, because they were very true to comic in that one, I just couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, and then, I mean, how many times did he swing that bat to the point where they show a headless Glenn? And it's just like, what? Just stop. I mean, it was so poorly done. So that's why the episode before, where you get all the way up to there, because that's, to me, that there's nothing better in that show. There is no episode that is better, because I was at the edge of my seat the entire episode, because you're wondering, like, who's going to get it? What's going to happen? And then they do that weak tease where you're like, come back next year, and then you can find out. I'm like, you assholes. That was a bad move. And then to come back to where it went was just disappointing all the way around.
Well, could you then say that season 7, episode 1 was iconic also in a bad way?
No, because I don't remember the episode. I mean, I only remember that it turned me off of the show. I remember the repulsiveness of Glenn, but I couldn't tell you anything else that happened in that episode off the top of my head. Everything in the episode before, I can tell you what happened. I mean, I remember the whole episode. So to me, that's more iconic. That moment of Glenn getting killed is probably iconic, but the whole episode, I don't think the episode is.
That makes sense.
All right, that's our list. You guys ready for what listeners chose? Their top 10.
Yeah, let's see what they got.
Drum roll. Number 10, Star Trek, The Next Generation, The Best of Both Worlds.
Hands down. Fantastic episode.
John's just like, okay. All right.
He's been assimilated by the Borg already. He's already part of the collective.
Ooh. I'm not going to, what's that? I'm not going to resist.
The Haunting of Hill House, Two Storms.
That should be higher up.
Wow. I'm surprised it's even on here, honestly. That's pretty recent. Battlestar Galactica 33, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Once More with Feeling, Seinfeld, The Contest. Now, in case you don't know what The Contest is, it's trying not to masturbate. It's to see who can hold out the longest. And the fact that there is actually a contest because they could go that long is amazing to me. But it's a great episode of television. MASH, The Death of Henry Blake. Ooh, that's a good episode. Breaking Bad, Ozymandias, Lost, The Constant is number 3, you'd be happy to know, Troy. And the final two, you know what's amazing for a show that so many people just don't want to remember ever again, but they can't forget these two episodes. Game of Thrones, Battle of the Bastards. Let's talk about that one first. Would you agree that is iconic?
Oh, for sure.
No, I actually don't.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's an amazing piece of television. I think it's great, but when it comes to Game of Thrones, only one of them sticks out in my brain. And one of them is by and far agreed on as one of the most iconic pieces of television, and that's not this one.
No, it's not. But I could see the case because it has probably the best battle scene ever in television.
True.
Even though I'm still saying Jon Snow got a break on that one, you know, a
little bit.
But it was still a fantastic battle because, well, let's face it, the opposition's plan was way smarter, which doesn't really happen in television that often, especially in shows like this. But number one is Game of Thrones, Reigns of Castamere, which you might remember is the Red Wedding episode. So the Red Wedding is so prominent, everybody calls it the Red Wedding episode.
Yeah, you almost think it's the title of the episode.
Mm-hmm. So what do you guys think about the Red Wedding? Why that one? Other than, you know, because I thought about this because I've rewatched, every season that came out, I rewatched the series up to that point. So I've rewatched season 2 at least eight times. At least. I don't know if that's sad or fantastic, but I have. Or at least 7 times. Sorry. And that episode still always works for me. So I guess you think it would be the surprise of it all, but it's really not. It's just it still catches you off guard in some way, even though you know absolutely everything that's happening. Can anybody explain this to me?
It's just everything from the acting, to the cinematography, to the way they laid out the story, to it's just everything about it was like hits every quadrant perfectly.
It lulled you into a false sense of security, much like they all were. And you kind of just was like sitting back going like, oh yeah, happy, joyous, you know, feast, whatever. And then all of a sudden it's like, stabbed, killed, death, destroy. Oh my God, what is happening on the screen? And then it's so iconic that they actually use it as a storyline in, what was it, season 7, episode 1, where she comes in and actually kills the entire family wearing his face.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so the fact that they like go back to that story point again just tells you how iconic that episode was, because then she comes in and does it like even more badass way.
Yeah, and Michelle Fairley, she played that so well. Like when her son is killed and just her real horrified grief at it all and realize it's probably her fault they're there. You know, I mean, just that realization is just phenomenal. Honestly, phenomenal. And also, you know, that is probably, even though we had the moment where Ned loses his head, you know, we've already had that. So you would think that would be the moment where people are like, oh, everybody is expendable now. You know, everybody, it's always up for grabs. I don't think it really sank in until the Red Wedding.
No, it really didn't. That's like, yeah, when they lopped off Ned's head, and that was the episode that made me go, okay, I can't ever stop watching this. But then I got lulled into a false sense of security, and I was just enjoying everything, and I thought Rob was getting to be really cool, and there's no way Caitlin's gonna, oh my God, they're dying.
So good. In terms of iconic, what's funny to me is I think I want to say it's season 6 finale. It's the one where Cersei unleashes the green fire.
Yes, because the whole time in the entire show, you're like, when are they going to blow up the town?
Yes.
When are they going to blow up the town? Is this the season where they're going to blow up the town? They keep talking about that green shit down there. When are they going to blow up the town?
And then that moment happens. And that's still, I think that's probably my favorite moment of this series ever.
Totally.
Is that moment. Because the music and the buildup and then her own son saying, I'm out of here. You know, just all of that was fantastic. Is there a television show that's had as many epic moments as that one?
I mean, even The Walk of Shame is pretty great, too.
Well, yeah. Shame.
Breaking Bad's probably gotten the closest.
I could see that. I could see that, but I don't know if it's the closest, but it's still not very close.
True.
Although ended probably better, according to many people. You know, I disagree. I think Game of Thrones had a great ending. Ah. All right. So, you know, I wanted to ask you, you know, we've talked about it on the show. Troy, you're a big TV fan, and I know you're also very critical of things done poorly. Do you think Game of Thrones ended okay?
I think that there were very much expectations at play because of the series and what it was. You put it up in the same category as that other show from an island. People got out of it what they put into it, and people got what they wanted if they wanted to get what they wanted, and it ended the way they wanted it to end. And the people that wanted it differently are the ones that are complaining about how it ended. I think when you go back and I think part of it is too, is that a show like that, very similar to Westworld, when you watch it week by week, it has a different feel and cadence to it than if you just sit down and watch it as a 10-hour movie or 6.5-hour movie, whatever the total runtime was for season 8, which I think more people were pissed off on. Oh, you're going to get, you know, less episodes, but they're going to be like 2 hours long. And then they were only like 44 minutes. I think that added to part of the problem too.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I think it ended the way it should have ended. I like who becomes the king at the end. I think that was fitting. I think there were some things that Daenerys, you know, did that were weird, and you go back and you like rewatch season 7 and season 8 and see the build up to it. I think it's totally justified at the same time. There's only one moment in the entire show that I'm unhappy with, and that's the fact that Jaime and Cersei got back together kind of. I really wanted Jaime to overcome that and be the hero, kill Cersei, and then as he's trying to escape, then he dies in the collapse of the building. And it's like you get the hero's fate. Like I finally overcame, but I still ended up dying anyway, versus just being a loser.
Well, not a loser, an addict.
Yeah, an addict. Yeah.
He's an addict. Yeah, addict's more. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my only one complaint. I really wanted Jaime to be like, I've been kicked my whole life. Here's my one chance to overcome, and he never overcomes.
No, he gets hit with the same rock. All right. So
literally.
what upcoming releases do we have?
All right. Well, coming out on video on demand on April 16th, we have Wildcat. It's a captive reporter must figure out a way to escape from the militants who ambushed her convoy in the Middle East while working through the trauma of her past. Stars Georgina Campbell, Luke Benward, and directed by Jonathan Stokes.
Following that, we have Jacob's Wife, also on VOD, and it is Anne, married to a small town minister, feels like her life is shrinking over the past 30 years. Encountering the quote unquote master brings her a new sense of power and appetite to live bolder. However, change comes with a heavy body count. Now, when I tell you that that's not a fair description of this movie, go watch the trailer of this, because what they're alluding to is actually a horror story and it looks fun.
All right.
All right. Well, then Vanquish hits theaters and video on demand on April 16th. It's a retired cop forces a former drug courier to do his bidding by holding her daughter hostage. Armed with guns, guts, and a motorcycle, she must now take out a series of violent gangsters or never see her child again. Unfortunately, it stars Ruby Rose, but does have Morgan Freeman to make that up, and is directed by George Gallo.
Can he, though?
I don't think so.
Depends if he has the caterpillar eyebrows or not.
I mean, George Gallo wrote Midnight Run, so there's a hope. Keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah, all right. All right. And following that in theaters also, we have Monday. And a spark on Friday can lead to a sizzling weekend fling. But what happens when you get to the inevitable Monday? This stars Sebastian Stan and Denise Goff.
Sebastian Stan breaking out from the Winter Soldier.
Look at that.
You know, his arm's detachable. That's what I heard. All right. So any recent film or TV recommendations not previously discussed?
Well, speaking of Monday, I did happen to watch finally for the first time What Happened to Monday. That was a fantastic film. So if you have not seen that, it's basically the future, and you can only have one child in your family, and this guy has seven and identical twins, and only one kid needs to go out at a time per day. So they're labeled Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and when Monday disappears, everybody else in the family now has to go figure out what happened to Monday and go find her.
Oh.
So it's a fantastic sci-fi piece. I would definitely check that out. And I think we talked about it on the show in the past. It's on Netflix.
Netflix, and I actually saw it, and I really enjoyed it. It's a lot of fun.
Sounds fun. Sounds like a horror story.
It's a great ending. The ending is fantastic.
It's Noomi Rapace.
Okay.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
It's pretty good. But the one I actually watched recently was A Week Away. If you couldn't tell from the West Wing episode, I'm the God guy. So this is basically High School Musical goes to summer camp, but with a Christian flair. Nowhere left to go, Will Hawkins finds himself at camp for the first time. His instinct is to run, but he finds a friend, a father figure, and even a girl who awakens his heart. Stars Kevin Quinn, Bailey Madison, and Jabriel Cook, directed by Roman White. If you are a fan of the Christian rock era of the 90s, you will absolutely love the songs and the cameos in this particular streamer on Netflix. I will warn you, though, it is 100% campy.
Sounds like church campy.
It's very church campy. But if you're a church camp goer like I was, this is right up your alley. If you're not a church camp goer, you'll probably be like, oh, I've seen High School Musical, I don't need to watch this. But
there's no Kirk Cameron, right?
There's no Kirk. It's not that campy. No.
Okay.
Willie Ames. Yeah. No. Willie Ames.
1990s Christian rock.
What is Willie Ames doing? Where is he at right now? That's what I want to know. What's he having? Is he at the Home Depot? Like, is his shift over?
Random pull.
You guys don't remember how in like the 90s he was like Captain God or something? He actually made a God superhero character that he was trying to push out there.
No, I don't remember that. That was I was busy watching other stuff. Probably Tarantino, would be my guess.
It was like him and Kirk Cameron were teaming up to force God down everyone's throat.
Yeah, this is not that.
It's not that. Okay.
It is a musical, so Aaron will not watch it.
I probably won't.
All right.
I did finish Them. You know, we reviewed the first couple episodes on our South by Southwest episode. I finally finished it. I think it starts strong, and then it just evolves into torture for torture's sake. Basically, it's okay. I think the acting is phenomenal, but the story just doesn't really go anywhere, and it kind of wanders a little bit, and then there's just torture for torture's sake. And then there's Thunder Force, which is Melissa McCarthy and Octavia Spencer together as basically superheroes. This was an exciting premise. Ben Falcone directed it. Stop letting Ben Falcone direct your movies, Melissa McCarthy. It was just okay. I think if you just want to watch something with your family you don't have to pay attention to, and you could probably knit or maybe do your taxes while you're watching it, perfect movie. But if you want something that's going to, you know, get you excited and really give you the laughs that Melissa McCarthy can deliver with the right director, especially Paul Feig, this isn't it. I really feel like there's some squandered potential here. But I will say Jason Bateman is Crabman in this, and he is freaking hysterical.
That sounds great.
Yeah. So there you go. Now, our weekly streaming recommendation is from HBO Max. John, what do you got?
All right, so I made HBO Max recently. I gave a show a try that I don't know if it's my usual cup of tea or not, but as soon as I started watching, I realized I was wrong. It is my cup of tea, and it's called Made for Love. A young woman on the run after 10 years in a suffocating marriage to a tech billionaire suddenly realizes that her husband has implanted a revolutionary monitoring device in her brain that allows him to track her every move. And that's not a complete description of what it is. It's he can see through her eyes, hear through her ears, know exactly what she's feeling or what her feelings are doing, and it's interesting. This stars Kristen Milioti and Billy Magnuson and Ray Romano. Ray Romano is fantastic in this. He's Kristen's father, and her stepmother's actually his sex doll.
What?
You heard me.
Okay.
it's easy to watch. It's each episode is about 25 minutes and every one of them kind of ramp up the weird quirkiness of a tech billionaire kind of thing. And it's fun. I really do suggest it. Kristen is a joy to watch on screen. She really sells it. Billy Magnuson, who you might know as like the hot guy in several different movies, is actually funny as well. It's just good stuff. So if you want something easy, light and fun, this is a good show for you.
Speaking of HBO Max, did anybody check out The Nevers?
Not yet.
I did.
And?
I did. I would say, legitimately, I would say, it's interesting. I mean, it definitely, you know, I know we're not supposed to say the name Joss Whedon, but he did leave the show, but he was the creator, and it does feel very much like a Joss Whedon show right off the get-go. Would you agree?
I only watched like 2 minutes and fell asleep because I was tired when I started it. So I have to go back and watch it again. Not to say that it's bad. I was just really tired that day.
It's really interesting. It feels very steampunky. I'm kind of curious what kind of show it's going to be after. I think he departed at episode 6. So I don't know what kind of show it's going to be after that moment. But I kind of dig it. I mean, it's kind of like an Avengers, not Marvel's Avengers, you know, the old Avengers. It's like that mixed with steampunk in a bit.
Would you watch it week to week or would you wait till it ends and then watch it?
The acting's really good. I definitely would.
Okay.
All right, well, share your thoughts on this episode or anything else in our Facebook group or on Twitter at BuyPopcorn, and our site is thehollywoodoutsider.com. You can always email us feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. You can find John's artwork on Insta and Twitter and at @RJohnDraws, Amanda on Veronica's Marshmallows, and the last episode of Smirk has dropped. So if you've ever listened to the Smirk podcast, the very final episode is now in your podcast feeds, and you can find Amanda at Sink Into This and me on The Blacklist Exposed and Presenting Hitchcock and at Aaron Smirks. Now, Blacklist Exposed, I do with this idiot. So, Troy, you want to tell people where they can find you?
Over at theblacklistexposed.com, or you could just go to about.me/Troy Heinrichs and find every podcast I've done, including all the ones Aaron mentioned, and one where, because Ms. Farrelly died in The Red Wedding, she came over to Resurrection on ABC in the second season. You can get that at resurrectionrevealed.com. That's a great show about people coming back from the dead.
Ooh, I like it, lucky. All right. Well, Troy, thanks for coming by, man. Thanks for doing this. Thanks for filling in last minute.
Great topic. Love it.
Yeah, Troy, that was great.
Anything more on iconic television we can eke out of this? Anything? All right, it's great. Okay.
The first day that 22 episodes dies will be an iconic television moment.
Yeah.
Can you believe they're still doing 22 episodes?
It's tough, man. I don't know. So like right now I'm rewatching Grimm, or at least I'm watching Grimm. I'm sort of rewatching it up until the point where I stopped watching it, and then I'll actually re-engage. These episodes kind of stretch out and I don't see the point of 22 episodes, and I'm kind of like kicking myself, but I'm also a completist, so I can't leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
That's really too bad. I really am looking forward to the day when network TV realizes that nobody wants to watch 22 episodes, but you know what? They're still getting ratings, even if they are diluted. They're still getting them. So people are watching. Somebody's watching every episode of CSI, whatever.
But if there's 26 television weeks in a season, you could do two shows for 13 episodes each that are both really good, or one that's just really drawn out.
Well, why wouldn't you want to just suck the life out of the room?
With 4 weeks of repeats.
Isn't that usually a bad thing? I think that's why they have an energy vampire and stuff. It's just...
We'll come back next week. We're going to have our classic corner where we're going to discuss Rio Bravo as well as our topic and other stuff. But so you got time to watch it. If you've never seen it before, it's a classic. It's on HBO Max as well. Rio Bravo. It's got John Wayne in it. And with that, remember the next time you head to a theater, buy popcorn. I'm going to keep doing that. I'm going to keep... Somebody actually told me I can't be a Sylvester Stallone fan. Who are you, bitch? So funny. I'm just like... And like all the vitriol. And now people are like, well, you know, he's never been a very popular movie star anyway. He's always been a has-been. I'm like, what are you talking about? Dude's been like part of some of the biggest franchises in history. What are you drinking?
His idea of what never is pretty weird.
Hey, Adrian, shut up.